speaker, and our final speaker, is Eckhard Wurtz. Eckhard is a senior research fellow in, at the Barcelona Center for International Affairs in Barcelona. So I assume he's also a big fan of Gaudi architecture. Have to be. He's formerly a visiting fellow at Princeton University, director of economic studies at the Gulf Research Center in Dubai, and has worked for banks in Germany and the United Arab Emirates. He has consulted on international and regional organizations such as UNCTAD, the Jeddah Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and the Saudi Ministry of Economy and Planning. As a contributor to international and regional media outlets, he's made contributions to places like the Financial Times, the National, Al Arabiya, and he's charted the rapid and economic development of the Arabian Peninsula. He's dealt extensively with food security, energy issues, and economic diversification. Sovereign wealth funds and financial markets have also been an interest of his. He's the editor of the GCC Financial Markets, the World's New Money Centers, and the author of a forthcoming book on oil for food, which will be published next year. His recent publications include, for instance, a book called The Global Food Crisis and the Gulf's Quest for Africa's Agricultural Potential. Sounds pretty controversial. So, Eckhard, if you'd be willing.
Hello, bonjour. Thanks for having me. It's pretty well known that the Middle East has a lot of oil, yeah? Two-thirds of global reserves and one-third of global production. What is less well known is that the Middle East also imports about a third of globally traded grain. So food security is a pretty big issue in this part of the world, and there's an acute sense of vulnerability of these imports. These imports are not only for human consumption. If you think the largest integrated dairy farm is in Canada or the US, you are mistaken. It is in Saudi Arabia, in the middle of the desert. The USDA assumes or estimates that by 2020, about 50% of the global poultry trade will be absorbed by the Middle East and by Africa. So there is not only a huge demand for imported cereals, but also huge demand for imported fodder crops, barley, alfalfa, and so on. Saudi Arabia alone imports 40% of the globally traded barley. So I think it's very important to keep that in mind and see how important the Middle East is for the global food system. Not only as a demand factor, by the way. The modern food system is highly dependent on hydrocarbon inputs. The fuels for the tractors, the fuels for the distribution networks, the fuels for pumping the water, for treating it, and so on. But also for fertilizers. And I'm not only speaking about nitrogen fertilizers, where the Gulf is a huge producer, mainly from natural gas, and where we actually see a trend, an increasing trend, that petrochemical production capacity moves from the US and Europe to the Gulf. I'm also speaking about phosphates. And phosphorus is an element, so you cannot replace it. Nitrogen, okay, I mean, it's basically you need energy, you need water, and you need air. Air, there's quite a lot of it. And theoretically, depending on the economics, you could basically substitute natural gas. Phosphorus, you cannot. Now, there was a paper in 2009 by Cordell basically warning about peak phosphate as early as 2033. Based on older USGS figures. The USGS has, in the meantime, in 2011, upgraded the reserve base massively of Morocco. And basically, according to these new estimates, peak phosphate is another 300, 400 years off. So we can all relax a bit, at least. Yet, you can see that the Middle East also has here a very important great importance for providing crucial input factors. Also, Saudi Arabia will have a massive phosphate project in Al-Jalamit coming on stream in 2014. Jordan is also a large producer. So the Middle East, a huge demand factor, but also a huge factor in supplying hydrocarbon inputs into for modern globalized agriculture. And without fertilizers, you cannot feed 7 billion people. You cannot even feed 5 billion people, maybe 3 billion people, if you're lucky. So it's really very important. And you can imagine that the food crisis in 2008 sent shockwaves through the region. I mean, I used to live at that time in Dubai, and it was palpable. Yeah, and overnight, politicians went into overdrive. What to do? Announced agro investments at food insecure places like Pakistan, Ethiopia, Sudan, and so on. Has made a lot of headlines. For them, it's a question how they manage it, yes? So often they feel uncertain with global food markets. Global food markets failed them in 2008, not so much because of the rising prices, at least as far as the rich oil producers are concerned. I mean, oil prices were beyond 100. They could easily afford these prices. What really worried them were the export restrictions, yeah, that agro exporters like Vietnam, like Argentina, like India, like Russia announced at that time. So they kind of faced that scenario that someday they might not be able to purchase food at any price, although their, even if their pockets were lined with petrodollars. Yeah. So basically, how have they perceived the global food crisis? How have they reacted to it? That's the topic of my book. It focuses mainly on the Gulf countries, but the book tells the story in a kind of wider regional framework and also deals with a couple of other countries. Food has also tremendous political importance in the region. I mean, everywhere it has such an importance. But maybe in the Middle East, even a bit more. We have so-called rentier states, economies that are heavily dependent on oil income, either directly but also indirectly in other countries like Egypt, for example, migrant remittances, transfer fees via the Suez Canal, where there are a lot of oil tankers, direct aid payments or investments from the Gulf countries. These governments, as a result, are kind of autonomous because they rely on external rents and not on tax collection. So it's a bit about no taxation and no representation. Yeah? You basically don't have political participation. You better shut up. But we are paying you welfare payments, yeah, in kind of as a little cookie. Yeah? So if this kind of unwritten social contract becomes under and faces pressure like it increasingly does, population growth, low oil prices in the 1980s, 1990s, there are frictions. Yeah? We have already heard, yeah, the Arab Spring basically would have happened without the food price hikes. Yeah? There are other reasons for it. And we've heard some of very important reasons today, like income deprivation versus food deprivation, or the role of moral economies and the sense that there's a violation of moral economies. Yeah. You can see here food prices obviously played a role during these demonstrations, but it's not that these people would have stared into the abyss of hunger. Yeah? Actually, the Middle East is pretty food secure according to the Global Hunger Index of IFPRI, which measures basically shortages in calorie intake. Yeah? Only Yemen and Sudan have really big problems there. Yeah? However, if we take a different methodology, as the IFPRI report Beyond the Arab Awakening does, which takes a look at stunting, yeah? Which measures the lack of micronutrients, the picture is much less sanguine. Yeah, you can see here this gentleman who is demonstrating. He doesn't really look exactly emaciated. In fact, 30% of Egyptians are obese, yeah, all in a country that has severe food security problems. So if you take stunting as an example, yeah, the picture is much less sanguine. Although the Gulf countries are food secure, still they feel food insecure. Yeah, why do they feel food insecure? Why do they try to basically get direct bilateral access to food production via agro investments instead of relying on world markets? One thing, their domestic agriculture is declining for the lack of water. You see here this craziness of subsidized wheat production in the middle of the desert, based on non-renewable fossil water reserves. Once you pump the water out of the ground, it's gone. that what has happened, so they are phasing it out now. So their import needs will increase. Another thing is geopolitical vulnerability. So what do Nixon, Kissinger, and King Faisal have to do with food security? I mean, food security is basically a geopolitical commodity, yeah, and time-honored means of warfare, and not only in the Middle Ages and sieges of castles. Also, for example, in the Second World War, there's this great book by Collingham about the taste of war, how basically food provision and denial thereof was an important means of warfare during the Second World War. Also in the Middle East, yeah, for example, it was always very important in the Middle East in the First World War and Second World War to entertain the right strategic alliances to ensure food imports. And famines on the Arabian Peninsula were only averted by supplies by the Middle East Supply Center in Cairo. It went on in the 60s that the U.S. withdrew food delivery under the Food for Peace program, PL-480, to Egypt in order to entice foreign policy changes. In the 1970s, then the U.S. mulled food embargoes against in retaliation to the Arab oil boycott. Nothing really happened out of the, it was never realized, yeah, and basically these food the one time such a food embargo was implemented in the 1980 against the Soviet Union, it failed. It basically just led to trade diversion, as Robert Palberg has shown in an article in Foreign Affairs at the time. Still, the kind of psychological damage has been done, and food security is widely equated with food self-sufficiency in the region. Yeah? But food self-sufficiency is not an option for lack of water. Yeah? You can, of course, there is room to make agriculture more efficient in the region, but there's no way, yeah, that the region basically could escape food imports and all the virtual water trade that these food imports embody. Yeah? Basically, the amount of food imports in the Middle East and the water that is needed to produce that food equals the water amount of a second River Nile flowing through the region. Yeah, 2 minutes. Okay. Maybe just as a last message, now they've announced all these agro investments. Yeah, okay, food self-sufficiency at home is not an option, but they don't trust world markets either. So at least let's get some direct access to food production in countries that are nearby where they have some political and cultural ties like Sudan or Pakistan. Now, this whole land grab issue has made a lot of headlines, yeah, and there's a huge media hype about it. Unfortunately, there's also a huge gap, yeah, between this separate media reality and what is actually happening on the ground here. You had sovereign wealth funds with not a single agro-engineer among their ranks announcing huge projects. Nothing has ever happened. Yeah? Even projects that basically have seen some degree of realization, like the wheat project of Aracin in Berber, 5,000 fedans, yeah, cultivated. So in the media, it figures as 100,000. In reality, they have basically a 25,000 lease option for another 25,000, but they are only cultivating 5,000 of it. Yeah. So one really needs to take that with a pinch of salt, and countries like Sudan basically are not the countries that provide the food imports of the region, but rather the usual suspects, the big grain producers, or in the case of rice, India and Pakistan, because the Gulf countries are only interested in the basmati rice varieties. So we will really need to see how that is going to develop. In my view, it can be only one part of the Gulf food security puzzle. They certainly will look more towards developed markets. As far as we have seen real implementation of projects, it was rather in developed agro markets like Brazil, like Australia, and so on. They have also announced the increase in strategic storage. We have heard today the importance of storage on a national level. Yeah? So if everybody starts to hoard food on a national level, they might create the very problems that they want to avoid, yeah? Illiquid markets. So there is a strong rationale, I think, for Middle Eastern countries to engage with other large storage holders like China, for example, and find some form of coordination and make markets here more transparent. Also, having said that there's a huge implementation gap, doesn't mean that there aren't problems. Yeah? You can see here the hydropolitics that are playing out on the Nile, very important going ahead. Ethiopia now openly questions the the Nile River Sharing Agreement of 1959 that gives three quarters of the water to Egypt, one quarter to Sudan, and nothing to the southern riparians. So if now the Gulf countries would basically enter the country on top of that, that of course would constitute additional demand on scarce water resources, and we will need to watch very carefully how these hydropolitics along the Nile are playing out. There's also a large room for cooperation, for example, dams built on the Ethiopian side are much more rational, less evaporation rates, and Sudan could benefit from it, Egypt maybe by buying the food produced there, and so on. But unfortunately, it's not happening so far. As far as the dams have been built, like in Sudan, there are problems, like you can see here, flooding and of areas around the Merowe Dam. And also here, basically, you see how after they had to phase out these projects in Saudi Arabia for lack of water, they are now doing exactly the same in Sudan. And there's a project at, Al Berber that I've just mentioned. So we will need to see how that plays out. But you can see, basically, this is not going to go away. They are very concerned about import security. I don't necessarily think that these agro-investments in food-insecure countries in the way they are undertaken right now are the solution, but ways need to be found how the Middle East, basically, how these concerns can be alleviated, and I think international cooperation is urgently needed in this field. Thank you.